Hello. We are coming down to the wire in a world in which the wire has become invisible, but the nature of the confinement is awfully clear. I hear from the president of the university, as you do too, that we will have an academic year in the fall, which of course is an acknowledgement of the fact that we will not be having an ordinary academic year in the fall, and that it is not going to be easy for anybody to maintain the fiction of charging full tuition for the usual experience. So the beauty of our creativity will be devoted to providing wonderful solutions that allow you to pay full tuition for not the usual experience. Everybody's calculations should begin now. After years and years of planning the course, planning your practice, I now have to decide whether I am prepared to teach planning your practice virtually, a course which in every respect I would have said required all of the personal contact and careful both bilateral discussions about the particular practice you are planning and the virtue of group discussion of what it feels like to plan a practice, all of which will now be extremely difficult. And either I am going to replan planning your practice as a virtual course, or I'm going to decide that it cannot be offered under these circumstances. But I will say this, if it can be offered, it can only be offered to you, that is to say, to students whom I have actually met before. I am therefore interested in whether you are interested in a virtual version of planning your practice, because it's in all likelihood going to be the case that if it will be offered, it will be because you want it and otherwise not. And you should be considering whether what you want is to return in the fall when there is no such thing as returning, which is different from the usual annual question, should you return to law school? As I say, I would expect that even fewer people will leave law school now than would leave law school under ordinary circumstances because, well, because you would like in the end to have gone to law school for your money. But it is possible that you will decide that the fall term of 2021 is not a term you want to spend in law school. There will be the truly quite important presidential election, and elections of all sorts of other people in this democracy who are going to have both the horrible experience of next winter's COVID-19 epidemic return and also the business of really beginning to dig this country out in 2021. And you may wish to be involved in that in whatever way it can be that you can be involved. Whatever the political economy of your situation is, you have, as I'm going to try and spend the next couple of hours demonstrating, a less burdensome and bleak economic future than most of the rest of your society. And I don't mean because there will be law firm jobs. I do think that it is both a good time to be becoming a lawyer and a bad time to be in law school. And I do think that with all of his high-flown rhetoric about the wonderfulness of our creativity and the reversibility of some of our expedients, Lee Bollinger may very well understand that. He is, after all, well acquainted with what it means to be in law school. So I don't know what your thinking will be over these months as the president says, ideas emerge. But your ideas should be emerging now, both about the immediate future, how you wish to structure law school, and the longer structure, how you wish to become a lawyer. And although I retain all of the tentativeness that I have been expressing in these past couple of weeks about the impossibility of doing the job so that it is about now and also about the future, none of us can accurately foresee I'm also aware that it is still possible to look over the horizon with you a little bit and with some confidence explain why you should still be confident. At this time in law school, at the end of the first year, confidence can be hard to gather because the weight of the exams is always so deeply too much. I think that the abolition of the grading system has probably helped that, but I'm not sure you've been as much helped as you think you've been, because in every interaction that we have, if you can call them interactions, which really you only can if you're willing to stretch a point, in every interaction that we have, I feel still the overarching weight of the idea of the exams. And nothing that I say will change that. I should make that the title of this course, in fact. The course should be called Nothing That I Say Will Change That, and then everybody would know what they are taking. But I mean that nothing that I say will change that, because even when we are seeing one another and looking one another in the eye and aware of the multiplicity of personalities on all sides of all our relationships, even then, nothing that I say will manage to affect that. But I do want to say, not only because of the abolition of the grading system, which is not a cause but really only a symptom, I really do want to say that the exams you are about to take do not matter to you as evaluations of your evolution in lawyering. There is always some idea, part of which was expressed in the class discussion last week, in the motive for regurgitation. There is always some idea that what is evaluated in the exams at the end of the first year of law school is how well you know how to learn the law, because now you are responsible for having mastered material. And that these examinations, unlike the law talk quizzes of the first semester, really somehow count for understanding how you know. And this is usually reinforced by the idea that the employers pay attention to these grades. And so because employers pay attention to them, they are important, both in the sense that they affect outcomes and in the sense that they reflect the fact that smart money thinks these are stocks worth watching. Both are false. And I've tried to explain before, even when we still occupied the same airspace, why they are false. But even as I know that this will not make any difference, let me just once again explain why operatively these exams do not matter. In the first place, anything other than a highly bureaucratized employer of lawyer does not pay attention to grades. I have explained how this functions in my practice before, but let me once again repeat the point. When I am hiring lawyers, and I am always or almost always hiring lawyers, not this spring, it is true, but when I am hiring lawyers, I never look at a transcript. A transcript does not convey any useful information to me. If the transcript would have told me that the student whose transcript it is performed brilliantly in law school, I have already read it in the cover letter. Because 0% of the cover letters written to cover those transcripts fail to say, I won the Sears Prize, or I am a Kent Scholar, or whatever the grade proxying title honorifically awarded by the law school is, everybody will have said it. And if there isn't an ancient honorific title ritually designating, then they will certainly say I was in the top X percent of my class if they go to a law school which ranks its class. But therefore, whatever the good news is, it is contained already in the headlines that the student has composed. And I do not need to look at a transcript to find out what the grades were that made somebody a Kent Scholar or won them the Sears Prize. I know all about that. Also, I do not look at a transcript to find out how good a lawyer somebody is. If she has been practicing law, her transcript contains no news whatever on that subject, because she has been practicing law, and what kind of lawyer she is found in her practice. If he has never been a lawyer before and is looking for the first job during or out of law school, then I cannot learn from the transcript anything that will not be duplicative of what I have learned in an interview, because I'm never going to hire a lawyer without an interview. And I'm experienced. I know what I'm looking for. I understand how to evaluate young people. And after a 45-minute conversation, face-to-face, working the way I and my law partner sitting next to me want the interview to be conducted, the opinions of some other teachers on some other blue books are not going to add anything that I can't have found out for myself in an experience I am not going to forego, no matter what the other law teachers thought. So, what good is the transcript? Now, in a world in which you have a lot of applicants for your positions, are you going to read the transcript in order to figure out which ones to interview? No. That's not going to be the way you're going to do it. You're going to look at who the person is on the papers with respect to the resume you have received and with respect to the recommendations you may solicit or the references you may call. But once again, what causes me to be interested in meeting a particular lawyer comes out of the mouth of that lawyer and other human beings I can speak to directly. It won't be found in the reflected judgments of somebody, even some teacher I respect, on some examination administered in a course. So, from the point of view of anybody other than a bureaucratized institution with a recruitment department, the transcript will not matter. With respect to the bureaucratized employer, the transcript may matter in the sense that there are cutoffs or there are algorithms, but at the end of the day, your individual performance in individual courses is not going to make the difference in whether that bureaucracy, among all the other undifferentiable bureaucracies, chooses to speak to you at any given moment. The stakes in any one exam remain vanishingly low. Even when the transcript is in use, any particular line item on the transcript is of almost zero meaning. So, what does it mean then to be concerned about the operational effect of your performance on any given exam into which you walk? It means that you are focusing too much on it. You are out of perspective according the test you are taking with more power than it can possibly have. The appropriate estimation of its effect on your life is very small. Whether zero or merely tiny is not a discussion worth having. The weight on you of the performance should not be significant. I know nothing that I say can change the fact that that is widely known to be wrong. I have offered the case. I back it with my own experience as an employer, my experience as a lawyer, a third of a century of law teaching, but I recognize that it will have no effect. Nonetheless, it's been said. And once, if one were permitted even to consider the consequences of that point, once one recognizes that the stakes in the exam from some long-term careerists are minuscule, then it becomes reasonable to ask, what are the stakes in the exam? For those not choosing to attend the course hour on the pad, I'm perfectly okay with that. You do what you want about it. But for those not attending, there was a conversation that went on at the last class hour, which I would like to expand upon a little bit. The pad, when used right, is terse. We don't need many words there, although we all use many of them because we're so glad to be in touch with one another that we overtype. I, too, as a teacher, am too wordy on the pad most of the time, though usually in the other course. But the interactions that occur there can be extremely useful if they are subject to a little bit of unpacking in your mind after it is over, or in the last two occasions on which we are together in this non-together kind of way. The question under discussion last hour was, what is the source of the difficulty, the strain, the tension involved in taking the exam, as opposed to its value? And I made the comment that an exam can be a very useful for you, the student, if a lawyer is taking it. And somebody asked me, please, to clarify what I mean, that a lawyer is taking an exam. And that's a useful thing to talk about, because I'm not sure that it usually gets discussed. The general psychological premise of examination is that there is a student who is under doubt, and there is a teacher with a question which must be answered. And this answer is supposed to produce a reduction of doubt about the student, right? To indicate of what alpha, beta, gamma, or delta, or epsilon tribe the student is. There's lots and lots of things wrong with this on a general level, whether you are talking about an undergraduate exam in literary studies or history, or whether you are talking about law school. This idea of what the exam is subject to some important general doubts. But let us just say that in law school, it's particularly dubious to think in these terms. From the point of view of the law school environment, an exam and an office hour are both actually occasions in which there are two lawyers, one of them more senior than the other, that is, more experienced, more licensed, more, let us use the word without irony, renowned. But really, there are two lawyers. And they are interacting with one another as lawyers always interact with one another, that is, purposively, with purpose, using words to make things happen in society. And the more junior lawyer, the person we call the one taking the exam, the more junior lawyer has a purpose in taking the exam. There is a lawyer taking the exam. In the same way that when we hold an office hour, a real one, that is, where there's an office and an hour and people talk to one another face to face, that there are two lawyers in every given dialogue. There may be other lawyers in the room in my office, because I think it's good for lawyers to watch lawyers work. But in the bipolar structure of dialogue at any given moment, two lawyers are speaking and listening, and each of them has a purpose. As I tried back when there were such things as actual office hours to point out, the act of walking into an office hour, like the act of walking into any other lawyer's office anywhere at any time, should have a purpose behind it. You should know what you want to have happen, and the words you use should be to make something happen. So what is it that the job is of the junior lawyer taking an exam? And this was the conversation that we came to next. And what I heard or read on the pad were the things that are usually said by people who have been conditioned to think of themselves as students taking an exam in law school. We are trying to tell the teacher what the teacher wants. Maybe the word was professor, because of course these are not mere teachers, these are professors. And we're trying to regurgitate the material for 4 hours. And these are indeed examples of trying, possible goals. But to my mind, they represent the way in which the lawyer has been suppressed back into the role of student, a supplicant trying to give authority what it wants. And of course, every lawyer's relationship to authority at any given moment could be characterized like that. I have a client. My client wants, needs, or must have some things. I am going to talk to authority on my client's behalf. And so I'm going to try and negotiate with authority. I'm going to give authority what it wants so my client can expect also to get what my client wants. And up to a point that there are lots and lots of purposive uses of words by lawyers that could be to one extent or another characterized this way. I'm giving authority what it wants in order to get what my client needs in some kind of bilateral relationship with the authority of the law. And that may be right, you know. We may find ourselves doing that. It's a little compromised as a way of explaining what is going on, but realism says if it is compromised in some ideal sense, but it is what is really happening, that we should pay attention to it and analyze it on that basis, and indeed we would. But I don't think it's what happens in the conversation between the junior and the senior lawyer that we call having or taking an exam. And so I said on the pad that I think that the purpose of a lawyer taking a law school exam is to earn the teacher's respect. Now, as I say, this seems to me a simple thing simply said and also simply true. The purpose for which you use words, taking a law school exam, is to gain the respect of the senior lawyer who is called teacher or professor or adjunct or whatever the hell she's called. The currency is respect. It is reflected in the proxy of the grade, and it is reflected in the activity down the line in giving a job recommendation or two or mentoring or support but in truth, of course, all of it is paid in respect. And one of the roles that senior lawyers can constructively play in their practices is to give respect to younger lawyers. This is the essence of the relationship between judges and law clerks. Of course clerks respect judges. That's the being a judge part. But of course, judges respect clerks, they respect. And when judges respect clerks, you see this in Judge Day's comment about her law clerks, that you have to learn to say what you think. Some never do. And in Judge Day's personality structure, in the complex relationship between her inner life and her external discerning, that's what it means to discern law clerks, right? You know, those you respect for saying what they think and those who never learn. Always in that relationship between senior lawyer and junior lawyer, there are both dark possibilities and light ones. And the light ones have to do with the earning of respect, however it is earned. When you know that you are capable of earning respect because you have adequate self-respect, a quantity of self-respect that is often not present in second semester lawyers in law school, because law school does not work to develop self-respect in them. It has other purposes, some of them purely antithetical, and it tends to develop self-doubt rather than self-respect. But when you have adequate self-respect to know that earning the respect of senior lawyers is possible, then it is easy to embrace the purpose of earning respect through the excellent practice of law. Junior lawyers can practice excellently, though their judgments may not be those that senior lawyers would make, because experience is crucial to the exercise of practical wisdom. But respecting younger lawyers is what we do if we are good at our profession and if we wish to carry on whatever it is the meaning of our practice to carry on. The exam, like certain kinds of conversations with senior lawyers, may be stressful, because the process of earning respect in any relationship can be stressful. The process of earning respect in marriage is stressful. The process of earning respect from parents is stressful. And it doesn't necessarily depend upon whether they are good at their side of the relationship altogether. In fact, it may be suggested that the worse they are at their side of the relationship, the harder it is to have a reasonable process of earning respect. But in the relationship, whether it is of the exam taker or the junior associate, it is true that the onus of earning respect falls on the junior. And as a law teacher and as an employer and supervisor of younger lawyers, as a law clerk once upon a time, and a judge never, but nonetheless, I feel, after all the decades that I have spent surpassing my younger self, who was callow and ridiculous and egomaniacal in many different ways, all of which, you know, it took 17 years of really excellent psychotherapy even to begin to overcome. When I look back upon my younger self in all the ways that he is less than I would love to think he was, I do recognize that I went about the task of earning the respect of the teachers under whom I learned and the judges and lawyers for whom I worked. And the businessmen with whom I interacted inside IBM, let us say. I went about the task of earning their respect honorably. My principles were that I said what I thought, but I tried not to be overbearing about it, an attempt I failed at almost all the time when I was young, and roughly half the time now. I didn't seek unnecessary confrontation or polarize situations in order to test or show my will. When you're young, that can be, you know, hard to do even when you ought to do it. But whether it was my own boss or the Chief Justice of the United States or my own supervisor inside the IBM law department or some executive or the CEO of some other company later in my practice, the respect that I wanted was the respect of mutual understanding. That I got what my senior was about, and that I was about whatever I was about, and that I could help us meet. I knew what I wanted to learn, and I knew that I could help out of the relationship to cause something else to be learned, whatever it was that I was advising about. And even if my memo was wrong, I still had a reason for thinking it was right and a reason for not arguing about it. In exams, you can and should be precisely that. The purpose of the exam is neither to tell the teacher what she wanted nor to fight with him about what he thinks. The purpose of the exam is to say what you think and explain why and take the heat of it, if heat there is, not as though it were a punishment or a failure, but as though it were the natural give and take between people thinking. The questioning of received wisdom is always a good idea, provided that you recognize that received wisdom is not there merely for questioning, but there also to reflect some consensus which, given a lawyer's theory of social action, you can approach from more than one direction. The received wisdom about consideration is this, and here is why it exists and has existed and refuses, despite its inherent inconsistencies, to die. And here are the inherent inconsistencies which make me feel, as generations have felt before me, that there's something wrong with this picture and that we ought to reconsider it completely. I got graded down in macroeconomics as an undergraduate, but my teacher, Bernie Safran, was a superb economist who served on Jimmy Carter's Council of Economic Advisors and was an economics left-winger in every respect. But like all the economics left-wingers of his time, he had an overbroad and deeply, ironically, uncritical admiration of Milton Friedman. I got graded down to a B+ from an A+ on the micro side. I got graded down to a B+ by Bernie because he thought I was a snot-nosed kid, because I wrote in my final exam in Macro 1 that Milton Friedman's article on why speculation in exchange rates helps to stabilize exchange rates was the single dumbest thing I had read since I started reading economic literature. And Bernie rightly thought that a snot-nosed kid might say that sort of thing about Milton Friedman. And rightly or wrongly believing, as he did, as the left-wing economists of his time did, that Milton Friedman was a genius, he thought that I deserved harsh criticism for my callowness. That was, which year was it, 1978? And later on in life, George Soros was to prove that Milton Friedman was indeed incorrect about it, for the very reason that I suggested in my undergraduate examination. Speculation did not actually stabilize exchange rates unless it happened to stabilize exchange rates, which sometimes it doesn't. And this, some deeper theory could be given about the nature of over market logic in the social thinking of the late 20th century and the like. But what I really want to point out is that after all these years, I'm not at all steamed about that. I think Bernie had a point and I had a point. And whether they met at B+ or A+ makes no difference whatever. I respected him and he respected me, even as he graded me down for being a snot-nosed kid, because it's perfectly conceivable that one should be respected, even though one is a snot-nosed kid, for something. Taking an exam is the process of having a voice and using it in a way which conveys to a senior the requirement of respect. If you fail, in the sense of not having gotten all the respect you thought you deserved, then good for you. Both of you have grown. And if you think that it's really a wonderful thing to sit and read all those blue books containing regurgitated matter, then of course you assume about the teacher that the teacher has the nose of a dog and really likes reading vomit, but it isn't true. And so you understand where the source of respect comes from when you pick up a blue book and it's got fresh air in it. Somebody is thinking in there in her own way, using words and thoughts to make something happen which she wants to have happen in the pages of this exam. I might have said under other circumstances, that's how you get an A. And it's a pleasure to be able to say, there's no such thing as A this time around. That's how you gain respect. Never mind the A, never mind even the clerkship recommendation or the job tips or the mentor, just the respect, enough that you came to the end of the first year in law school and you had things to say which commanded the respect of people worth talking to. If you can't stand taller on the basis of that, well, then we need to help your posture in some other way. Now, that's a lawyer's theory of social action applied to the question of the exam. A lawyer takes the exam in order to get the thing the lawyer knows is really necessary out of the thing, which is respect, which might come, oh, by the way, of the ostensible meaning of the conversation. Because our way of thinking about social life is to look at its layers. Our way of thinking about personality is to look at its multiplicity. Our way of thinking about the engagement of human bodies in social life is to think about the biology. I'm sure that seemed less important when I said it in February than it is when I say it now. Because the remembrance of the biological layer of human social analysis, we could hardly forget that under present circumstances. The minute that we're not thinking about virology anymore, however, all the artificial epidemiologists will go back to being whatever they are the rest of the time, sports blowhards or whatever. But it will still be a good idea to remember to think about the biological layer of social interaction. And the recollection that once upon a time we had an epidemic in which everybody was equally immunologically naive. Nobody had built-in immunity to the virus, and yet magically the people who died, they were the black, the brown, the not fully abled, and the poor. And so we discover that in addition to being health workers and being essential and being poor, we were also able, through social structures, to modulate the virus into a disease. And the disease, that was a social product. And because we see that these layers interact with one another, and we know that we should always be looking for those interactions across different ways of understanding society, we have now a lawyer's theory of social action in two senses. First, we are lawyers. So our theory of social action is an active theory of social action. Its purpose is to enable us to choose wisely words with which to make things happen in society. A lawyer's theory of social action supports not scholarship or knowledge for its own sake, but lawyering. Making things happen in society using words. But also, a lawyer's theory of social action is not a specialist's theory of social action, an economist's theory of social action, which, oddly enough, will turn out to be about economics. Or even a primatologist's theory of social action, far better, but still limited to thinking about primates. We're not specialists in a particular way of knowing. We're specialists in figuring out how to draw upon multiple ways of knowing in order to achieve social consequences. The theory of social action is a theory of action because art for art's sake won't pay the nut. Because whether we are engaged, as Holmes would like to say, in predicting the incidence of the public force, or whether we are tinkering a little more actively than that and trying to modify around the edges and incrementally and specifically with respect to the interests of our client, the actual behavior of the public force, not merely to predict, but to deflect, intensify, disable, undermine, or temporarily abort, whatever it is that we are trying to do with the incidence of the public force, our doing it depends upon having more than one way to skin a cat. A lawyer who only knows one way to skin a cat is a cat skinner, not a lawyer. And this, the problem of multiplicity in approach, is why creativity is hard. Because as human beings, we admire certain. And we wish repose. But certainty is generally an illusion, and repose is not the destiny of human beings. In other words, we are compelled to act. We're lawyers. If we take money for not doing anything, sooner or later, unless we are Wachtell, Lipton, Rosen, and Katz, people will stop paying us. And in order to do things, in order to take an active role in the world, we have to be prepared to recognize that there aren't any certainties. And, well, as Oliver Cromwell says, those who want to do work in the world can rest in the grave. So, how much anthropology should there be in our theory of social action? How much sociology? How much personality psychology? How much social psychology? Abraham Lincoln is correct. A man's legs should be long enough to reach from his body to the ground. The importance of realism's insistence that things are what they do rather than what they are called is to prevent the ground from shifting underneath. From all that trapezing of Felix Cohen's, where the ground isn't there. The ground is there. The beauty of certain kinds of social circumstances, as for example a pestilence, is preventing this failure to get from the body to the ground that arises when you think that a malaria drug might be a beautiful, miraculous, wonderful solution to the problem of the epidemic devastating your society, but you have to actually go and find out about that by giving some to some people and none to others and seeing what happens. That there is, in the end, a ground, that there is society and one can know about it, is the only epistemological conviction that the lawyer has to have. That in the end, it is out there. This can be particularly difficult for us at this one moment because, well, on the one hand, we see that society is out there, and on the other hand, we see that it is out there. And this is why John Dewey is correct, that, you know, we learn by experimenting with the world. And all of the difficulty that we are having right now in learning, I in teaching, you in learning, but both of us in doing both parts of the job, the difficulty that we have is that the out-there-ness of the world makes experimenting with it very difficult. I cannot say a thing while I am listening to the room and watching the eyes of the people listening to me and know that I have said it wrong and try to say it a better way that will reach more fully than in the next millisecond or two or six or 7,000. The sense that we are experimenting with the world is also at odds with the idea that what we're trying to do is get a $190,000 a year job and keep it. That is to say, this particular role of the lawyer, to be scrutinizing social process from multiple perspectives, to be using that multiplicity of angles to generate a three-dimensional internal model of a piece of writing or a piece of testimony or a social process or the markup in the committee of a piece of legislation underway, the ability to see it in whole and to walk around it and to contemplate it is inherently at odds with the idea of simply doing what you're told and being a cog in the machine. This is part of the reason why being a lawyer in a free society is different than being a lawyer in a society like that generated by the Chinese Communist Party, in which there is rule by law rather than rule of law. Because in the end, the process of thinking independently about social action, finding the clients who need your help and betting your professional substance on your ability to help them is at odds with being simply a workman turning out documents on the lathe one after the other, pick up material, put on lathe, grind to, etc. The idea of the law as practiced in an industrial army came very late in the last 1,000 years, essentially 2 generations before yours. The idea of the lawyer as an independent, pursuing interests, not necessarily his, then mostly his own, but always with some meaning attributed to what he's done. The meaning of Mr. Tulkinghorn's practice is knowing the secrets of the great, not merely effectuating family settlements. The process of being an independent should have appeal to you. Both as a thinker, when I walk into an exam, what is going to go into the blue book is what I think, and as a human being navigating the world you see being reformulated around you. In my lifetime, the United States went from a relatively equal society, in which, in particular, in the generation in which I was born after the Second World War, the middle class incomes in the United States rose much more rapidly than the incomes of the richest. And in which, indeed, over my childhood, the very richest people in the United States lost proportion of income rather than gained it. It went from being that society to being the society in which Senator Sanders was literally quite accurately correct. The three people own more wealth in the United States than the bottom half of American society. Right now, Senator Sanders was literally correct about that. The wealth of Mr. Bezos, Mr. Gates, and the Sage of Omaha is greater than the wealth of the bottom half of the entire United States society. Now, I respect Warren Buffett, and notwithstanding having spent a large part of my life in adversariality to him, I respect Mr. Gates and Mr. Bezos. Well, he's very rich. But only a society of a certain kind could even manage to bring about such concentration of wealth. It isn't merely that Thomas Jefferson would not approve, it is more that it could not occur in the society of which Thomas Jefferson was a member. We have created incentives to the concentration of wealth, power, and authority more than sufficient in law school language to bring those results about. In doing so, we have also created a society in which self-sustainability, self-reliance, self-sufficiency, and independence are therefore overwhelmingly valuable. It's only necessary to see what the shock is being administered to the society around you in the course of the epidemic to understand why that's true. If you can manage to sail your own boat, then in a storm like this one, and I don't just mean the immediate lockdown of the epidemic, but in the depression that follows, you have an enormous advantage. The Nobel Prize winners of economics aren't necessarily the smartest people in the world, but they're clever. And Paul Krugman and Joe Stiglitz may not be exactly representative of all the people who ever won Nobel Prizes in economics, nor even of all the living Nobel Prize winners in economics, but again, you know, it's not merely their university credibility, it's their skill at understanding that we respect. Joe was interviewed earlier this week saying, of course there's going to be a Great Depression. Yes is the answer to that question. All right. Economists are often wrong, Paul Krugman and Joe Stiglitz included. And yes, just because a thing seems simple however previously unimaginable it is. Joe says, and of course, if we'd had a different government in the United States, it would have been easy to avoid it. That's also true. A strange but undoubted fact for him. And I think in the end, history will at least indicate that he was right. Whether it will justify him for having said it, that's a different question. But right. In other words, we should anticipate a lengthy period of immense economic instability and, well, deflation. Negative prices for a barrel of oil will not last, we can be sure of that, but the onset of the wild, volatile irrationality of a highly pressurized global economic machine coming apart, the sounds of piston rods breaking through seals will be very common for the next many years. It sounds like a terrible recipe for the professional class, but you will have advantages, particularly if you have a lawyer's theory of social action and a determined commitment to independence, self-sufficiency, self-reliance, and sailing your own boat. See, the problem of the largest organizations in a structure like this one is they have the highest overheads and therefore the most inflexibility in the construction of their undertakings. You can put your mind to what you put your mind to. Wherever you can find a way to cover your nut, that's your book. You don't have to carry with you an enormous overhang of real estate and people and past commitments and existing clients you can't afford to lose and all the rest of the panoply of problems that will now beset the world's existing practices of law and social organizations of every other kind. Mitch McConnell doesn't really mean that 50 states should all go bankrupt, which they're not legally allowed to do and which constitutionally might be rather doubtful. He's merely taking the negotiating position about the coronavirus reconstruction aid in the United States Senate. But let's just imagine for a moment what would happen if 50 United States were all in bankruptcy court next year. And of course, there is a lot of stuff that is about to happen. All the ways that if we were Judge Day, sitting at home, not riding on the subway, not going to chambers, not listening to oral arguments, we would be very well aware of all the litigation roaring towards us. The business interruption policy litigation that's going to go on between the insurers and all the restaurants and hospitality companies of the United States. And the liability litigation that will follow from workers getting sick on the job or customers or guests or other forms of civil society interactions with businesses resulting in illness and harm. All the labor litigation, all the employment litigation, all the different pieces of stress being pushed through the whole of society and taken up in places where dispute resolutions of all kinds then have to occur. All of this is, well, money for lawyers. But it's easier to get to when you have a lightweight structure and you don't have overhangs of hundreds of people's salaries to cut and worries about how to keep your rent paid. And The world of the small business of today, unable to make its payroll and worried about falling out of the sky, is not your worry because you don't have a payroll right now. And asset prices are going to fall and things are going to be possible for you that, well, would be possible for other larger entities to get to, but that they're not accustomed to living on the small scale. Their knees are way too stiff to pick up the pennies on the sidewalk. Of course, that doesn't sound like $190,000 a year guaranteed and a great opportunity to get a partnership 9 years later. But you see why all of that pie in the sky when you die stuff doesn't come through the period of the plague very well. Why it isn't really what people want to know. And why, of course, it doesn't answer to the need for meaning. Sometimes I used to end American legal history, the story of American law from 1607 to 1954. Always I used to end with Brown against the Board of Education, and often alongside Brown and the wonderful study of the legal campaign that led there by Richard Kluger. Sometimes I used to end with My World with Louis Armstrong. And any time I didn't, I felt sorry that I didn't. Music in law school, it's a subject, well, I mean, it's a narrow subject, as you know, esoteric and confined. I learned about music in law school because Charlie Black used to have one night a year when he would convene an evening, whether in the Case Lounge at Columbia or in the Faculty Lounge at Yale, and he would carry in his heavy lacquer platter recordings of Louis Armstrong and his Hot Five from the late 1920s and play 78s for people. I always understood that Charlie was doing that in the evening because it was Yale Law School or Columbia Law School, and you really couldn't do it in the classroom. And it's true. I mean, mechanically, that would have been a much heavier lift. But I knew that if he could, he would, and so I do. Late in Charles's life, when I was a young teacher at Columbia, and Charles hadn't had a drink in many a long year, we would meet in the evenings after I finished teaching in his and Barbara's apartment, and I would drink scotch for him. And you know, he had the benefit of paying respect to the snot-nosed kid I was, and I had the benefit of paying respect to the just transcendently oddball artist that he was, and we could drink together in my glass. And I feel when I put up the overture of the Savoy Blues that I'm pouring a glass and leaving a cigarette burning in the ashtray for him. But I'm also trying to say something about what a practice means. Because that essay is one of the most just crystalline examples. Only in the hands of an artist like Charles could that be achieved. Charles, too, was a poet. I always thought that Charles was a better painter than he was a poet, but he was both in an inimitable way. And of all his poems, this is the best, though he would not have agreed with me about it. And the reason that it is the best, as Larry Joseph's never written better poetry than Lawyerland, is that they are both soaked in the meaning of the word as a lawyer means a word and as a poet means a word, and they can master both of them at the same time, which is quite a trick. The meaning of Charles's practice wasn't like that of most working lawyers, made again from day to day and expressed in like a Seurat painting in a thousands of individual dots. The meaning of Charles's practice, like the meaning of the best practices of most legal academics, was to be found in the pinnacles. He was lucky, as we are lucky, he got to choose his spots. But the meaning of Charles's practice, like the meaning of yours or the meaning of mine, is to be found in two conflicting principles, those of presence and of absence. A practice means what its details mean. The choices that you make about how you pay the rent and how you do what's most important to you in an emotional or political sense. How you choose the work that you do and the balance with which you do it. How you sound the chords of your lawyering in the way you practice the craft of it. What you file, what you sign, the way you conduct the forms of social life that you conduct, whether they're real estate closings or counseling people on their estate planning arrangements or whatever else. It isn't all grand theory, and it isn't all matter of moral, ethical, or political principle. Being a lawyer is more interesting than that. But it isn't not that. The meaning of Charles's practice for him is the avoidance of tragedy in society. The meaning of Charles's practice is the reversal of that great prima materia of tragedy, the failure to recognize kinship. In the failure to recognize kinship, there is also the failure to pay respect. What it means, as Charles says, to see genius for the first time in one's life, in the presence of someone who the people of one's society and community, the respectables, the peers, the kin, think of as nobody. After all, it's just a goddamn so-and-so. I would point out in passing that though I don't hear use that word, it's important that Charles used it, that we recognize that it's there, that that form of absolute dismissal of another human being that lies behind the use of whichever the word is, kike applied to me, or kafir, or, well, that the presence of that absolute failure to recognize human kinship. That is the tragedy, and the markers of that tragedy are the blood on the stage and the words we don't like even to hear said. But the meaning of Charles's practice is the overcoming of that. The meaning of Charles's practice was both the importance of that goal and its ironic achievement in a coalition of minds and hearts and spirits that embraced both Thurgood Marshall and Charles Lund Black Jr. And of course, from my point of view, it's impossible to differentiate the meaning of Louis Armstrong to Charles and the meaning of Thurgood Marshall to both him and me. How could it not be relevant that the greatest lawyer I ever knew and the greatest lawyer I ever worked for was an American who looked not like me, but like Frederick Douglass? How could it not be important to the meaning of our practices, his and mine, and Thurgood's for that matter, how could it not be part of the meaning of our practice that we shared an idea about America that involved a recognition of kinship across a line of hatred? How could that not have affected us when we thought about other things about which we either vehemently agreed or vehemently disagreed over all those years? It wasn't about the respect of thinking the same way. It was the respect about meaning the same thing. Your practice is meaning, if you set it for yourself, will change and modulate and alter over decades. I will allow myself in our last class that does not meet the chance to talk about the meaning of my own practice, what it has come to mean, what it started out to mean, why it has meant those things. But I still find it more useful or comfortable or something to think about this in terms of both Charles's and yours than of mine. For you will, of course, also have a meaning to your practice. Whether your practice fully expresses its meaning will be for you to decide. Like Helen Thoreau, I hope that, like Martha Thoreau, I hope that you will feel the meaning of your practice vitally within you, not as a dullness or a dimness that separated you from the meaning of your practice, that alienated you from the meaning of your practice, if I can get all Marx's A for a moment. Because, of course, that really is the dimness that she's talking about, isn't it? It's the alienation of the lawyer from the value of her work that leaves one in middle age wondering, why am I so miserable? And pulling others downward into that misery with you. That's the problem of not having a practice that gives that sense of meaning. When you mean your practice, you go to work every day worrying about how to make the rent and how to cover the nut and how to get this problem to go away and how to deal with those fools or undermine those assholes or whatever it is you're doing, and it's just doing it. But when the meaning of it is real to you, when the doing of it, however detailed it may be, however the craft may be working or not working for you emotionally today, this week, this month, this year, when the practice reflects the meaning, you are gaining energy from the work you do. Because you are feeling the significance of your life as you define it. The biggest problem with pawning your license for a salary and doing other people's legal work is when that meaning doesn't coincide with yours. Whatever the meaning is of whatever it is, it's not your meaning. I was happy doing IBM work as the caboose on the train at Cravath, carrying Evan's bag, doing the things that a kid lawyer could do, because the meaning of what I was doing was still a meaning I attached to it. I knew that there was lots of other work in the firm that wouldn't have had that meaning at all for me. And I didn't want to wind up doing that work. And when I watched the people inside that law firm shuffled from work that had some meaning to them, the work that hadn't, whether they were newly minted partners with a ton of money and a broken marriage or not, I still thought, that's not my future. It may be that you will ultimately conclude, for a variety of reasons, that the meaning of your work is that it supports your off hour. That the life you lead is otherwise meaningful and that the work is what pays for it. And if it comes to that, why would anybody criticize? Certainly, why would I? That a life without meaning will ultimately lead to misery, I do believe, but that the meaning must be found in the work, that's not obvious. But I will tell you that if what you want is that, it's odd to go deeply into debt to go to law school. This would be true even if I thought that we were about to live in an inflationary economy and that the value of your debts would decrease to the lender over time as the currency inflated away, and that isn't what I think is about to happen. In a deflationary time, you would like to have less debt, not more debt. But it isn't for that reason alone, because you're carrying a mortgage on it. It's because when you're carrying a mortgage on something, the only purpose of which is to fund something else, then really you're just in the house flipping business. And lawyering is a hard trade to be in the house flipping business for. To be merely transactional about it, oh well, you understand. I mean, that's why I think Carl Wiley is useful to us. It's good to be excellent at what you do. It's good to command respect. It's wonderful to be rich, and it may very well be better to be lucky than smart. But to be a person whose work it is to make things happen in society using words, and then to be unable to attribute any deep meaning to the things one is making to have happen, is a sad fate. Really the fate of Sisyphus, if you come to that. Because it's the absence of the meaning, the futility, that is the punishment, that causes the hurt, that is the harm. Here, at the end of law school, first year, when everything is so high stakes, we all know it's very high, the stakes, high, kid, high, very high. Those exams, very important. Those grades, very significant. This is why the legend of law school, the Harvard legend of law school, is that you go with your rich girlfriend to the Cape and you make a paper airplane out of your grades and you throw them into the Atlantic Ocean. I will agree that it, when there is a grading system at the end of the first year of law school, it is good not to care. You are the people I will not have to even say that to, though nothing that I say would matter because there are no grades, and so you won't have to worry about that, and you are a thought experiment in liberty, and as in so many thought experiments in liberty, it begins to look in the early going like liberty is not all that happy-making, but you should be liberated. I put those in lowercase letters. I am not the President of the United States. You should be liberated now. Not from lockdown, not from disease, not from fear of death and harm to the people you love and economic chaos, but from the burden of having to be what somebody else wants. Now is the time to attribute meaning. Like Charles in Austin at 19, listening to a dance band. The meaning of what you are about can be found in the life around you now, if you look, even as thin and captive and impoverished as we think it is. The meaning of the practice can be found there. Maybe it will sound highfalutin to me because you'll come and talk to me the vocabulary of I want to make things better for the poor and downtrodden of the earth, and my question will be, yeah, so how, just exactly which, down, how trodden of the earth are we talking about? Because it is the ability to see the reality of the thing that makes the poem. But in the reality of the thing is something larger than itself or than yourself or than the job that anybody could offer you, and then you wouldn't take any job that they could offer you. When you know, really know, that there is no job anybody could offer you that you would take, because what you're doing is what you want to do, and anything else would be a compromise of what you want to do with something that somebody else wants you to do. When you know that, and it is quite possible that you will find that early in your life, when you know that nobody can offer you anything that is better than what you can make for yourself, then you are free. And the minute you are free, I guarantee that the first thing that will happen is you will begin to want to understand how you can bring about others' freedom. Talk to you one last time soon.